Before we start, this episode contains some chat you might find upsetting, so do check the show notes for more details if you need. Hello and welcome to Happy Place with me, Fern Cotton. This is the show that allows space for personal truths to be voiced and heard. Today, I'm meeting Sir Bradley Wiggins.
People say, oh, it's a shame you've fallen out of love with cycling. I was never in love with it. It became a religion. You don't fall in love with a religion. You adopted a religion, and I adopted a religion of cycling. And now I've left my faith. You should get back on the bike. You know, it's a shame you lost the love for the bike. Normal people love cycling. They go out, they love getting the bike. I can't stand it. I hated cycling, really, the act of riding a bike. It just gave me, it was a means, it was to facilitate what I wanted to do in my life.
Cyclist Bradley Wiggins is a Tour de France winner and five times Olympic champion. The only rider to win both the Tour de France and Olympic gold in the same year. Bradley is a hugely celebrated athlete, an icon in British sport. But that legend, Sir Wiggo, was a character of sorts, a public-facing persona that helped him hide from who he really was and what he'd been through. In 2022, Bradley sat down for an interview with Alistair Campbell in Men's Health magazine. This was the first time he spoke publicly about being groomed by a coach as a teenager. As a result of his own experiences, he's been working with the NSPCC on their Listen Up, Speak Up campaign to raise awareness about child abuse, and the NSPCC also set up a support line for fellow cyclists. Bradley is also the current Mind Charity front cover and interview, encouraging people to talk about their mental health, and is supporting their charity bike ride, which takes place on Sunday, the 28th of May. It took Bradley a while to find my house, but once he got here, I was so incredibly grateful and privileged that he felt able to have this very moving conversation with me.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I know you're very keen to hear from Bradley, but just before we get to him, I want to tell you about this year's Happy Place Festivals. They're going to feature some of the gorgeous well-being experts that you know from the podcast and the Happy Place app. They'll be doing meditation sessions, yoga, breathwork classes, and loads of really cool stuff. And if you can't wait till the festivals, you can experience lots of their practices on the Happy Place app now. I am so excited that we're going to be announcing our first guests of the 2023 festival lineup this week. So do keep an eye out on social media. All right, here's what you've been waiting for. Here's the show. So Bradley Wiggins, good to see you.
Thank you for having me, Fern.
Are you well today?
I am actually, yeah. I'm a bit rushed this morning trying to find here, but we got here eventually.
You had a wild goose chase to find my house, but I'm glad that you've made it here. We've got lots to talk about. I'd love to talk, first of all, about the Mind Ride London to Essex campaign that you're involved in.
Yes.
It's happening in May. Why do you want to be involved in it? How can people get involved to help with what Mind are doing?
It's in May. The Mind have got a few places extra to fill up, and I think cycling is it's a real passageway to freedom and mental freedom. Really, it's there's a famous quote, well, saying actually within cycling that outside is free, and you know everyone has access to a bicycle, and it has the ability to change people's lives. People getting on a bike, and obviously there's the obsession side of it, and people get carried away and start spending lots of money, but. You know, just getting a few people on these bikes and filling up these places. I think it's the first time this ride's been back on for a few years because it's been canned. It's a great opportunity to find some people and get them involved in it and hopefully change their lives. So it's something that I've really got behind because cycling, I'd be nothing without cycling in my life. It's given me everything. and at the same time it nearly took everything away from me. So
yes, because you've had a, you know, from the articles that I've read that you've done recently, although it's been an incredibly successful journey and part of your life, it's definitely been a complicated one.
It has, but I'm adamant that had it not happened, I wouldn't have had the success I had. I believe that all my success stemmed from adversity and running away from problems in my life. And I think that was the difference between good, being good at something, and great at something. I think greatness stems from adversity. I had to deal with all that stuff when I stopped cycling when I was 36, really. It's why I had sustained success as well, because it was always on to the next thing, always moving on to the next thing. And I'm a freer man now. I've dealt with it all in my head.
So having that sense that you were running from pain and the past, did you, when you were sort of having that ascent in your cycling career, did you assume that when you reached the pinnacle of success that you would feel free from the past?
No.
No?
No, because I didn't know I was running from it at the time.
Oh, right.
The main thing that drove me throughout my cycling career was fear. And that emotion was fear, really. And so when I look back, the fear, I never knew where it stemmed from, really. I was always a scared person, really, most of the time when I was going into events, going into Olympic finals and things. And it was always the fear of losing. And that fear of losing was something that stemmed from my childhood, really. I don't know why. I haven't really dealt with that yet. But it's certainly when I looked back at my career, there was no joy. There was no enjoyment. There was no enjoying the moment, the success. It was just, it was like ticking a box. And winning became the normal, winning became the standard. And it was always a case of moving on to the next thing. And when I didn't have something to move on to, I'd slip away and start drinking and things like that. So I'd get bored very easy. So I needed something to occupy my mind, really, and focus in on objective, which was far enough away down the distance that I could go through a process and occupy myself in the process and keep myself busy. Routine for me and distraction and having a goal on something was a great distraction from dealing with looking at myself.
So would you say that reaching that pinnacle of success, which I'm sure you would equate to being winning the time trials at the Olympics in 2012, Tour de France triumph, were they the moments where you had to start examining that and go, oh, well, I've done the things I wanted to do, now what?
Yeah, I think the Olympics was a big one in London because that had been so far down the road. Obviously, they announced the Olympics in London 2007. So that had always been like a long-term objective, 5 years, really. But when I achieved it, I won the Tour de France and I won the Olympics 10 days later. And I think I said to Matt Dawson at the finish of Five Live, give me an interview, and I said, I don't think it's ever going to get any better than this and I don't know what I'm going to do now, really. And that was the reality of it, really. Is I was almost annoyed that it was over because I had nothing else. I had no daily routine after that, what to do. I didn't know what I was getting out of bed for in the morning. So I slipped for the next 5-6 months after that, really, into kind of playing this character. And I was famous and I didn't know how to handle it. So I played this kind of veil of a rock star kind of thing. And that was just for my insecurity, really, and adopted something that I perceived to be quite cool. But yeah, I never really got back to the heights after that. I won things after that and won world titles and things like that. But in terms of like a mental, you know, kind of achievement, that was as good as it ever got. But then I decided that the Olympics in Rio was going to be my last Olympic Games. I got to that and I knew I was pretty much going to retire then. I was done pretty much. I craved normality, but I didn't know what normal life was for me, really. So I struggled ever since then. I went into rowing after that. I took up rowing with a view to maybe try and make another Olympic team in rowing, but you don't pick up rowing just overnight. You know, it took many, many years. So it's I struggled after that, really, yeah. And then I think from that point on, then I started addressing myself really, dealing with stuff that had happened in my childhood that I hadn't accepted.
So that's really been a time of healing from that moment where everyone would assume you're on top of the world, it's the best day of your life. That was almost the start of something unravelling?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my career, I mean, I'm proud of it and it means a lot to me, but it doesn't define me. And I think it's not something now that I sit back and look on and sort of think, God, they were the best years of my life. They were just, whatever I do now is almost going to, like this stuff that I'm doing now has been much more rewarding, really, much more fulfilling as a person. But it's a funny thing, you know. I just think lots of people don't accept and deal with things that they did until they get older. I didn't because I had to adopt a persona which was one of a sportsman, really, which you could not be perceived to have any weaknesses or any chinks in your armour. And so you've got to be too cool for school the whole time, really, and you can't let your guard down 1 minute. And it's obviously once you stop and that's gone, I think a lot of it to do with when my son is a cyclist now, really, and he got to the age of 13 and I started, it was like looking in the mirror. Mm. You know, he started having coaches and things around him, and then I realised what norm is, what normality should be, really. I think that's when I started addressing sort of certain things that had happened to me, really, and the abnormality of my childhood, really, and how it shouldn't have been like that. But at the same time, you know, we're all products of our childhood and products of our environment, and I wouldn't have achieved what I achieved, and I wouldn't be the person I'm sat here today had I not had that. So, mm-hmm. And I'm not alone. And I think that's one of the things as well, once you start talking about this stuff, you realise you're not alone.
Yeah.
And I think that's been the most liberating thing.
Yeah, without a doubt.
You know, something that was your greatest embarrassment and shame, which is one of the reasons why you don't talk about a lot of these things, is something that actually makes you is the most empowering thing for you when you do come out and talk about it and start speaking to people and then see the opportunity available to you after that in terms of what you want to do at work. Because one of the other things as well, once I stopped cycling, I didn't really know what I wanted to do in my life. So I went on the jump to begin with, hated it. And then I went down the whole avenues of like corporate speaking, you know, keynote speaking and things like that. But nothing was really hitting the spot and rewarding me and fulfilling me. And funnily enough, it's the stuff I've been doing recently, launching a campaign for the NSPCC and stuff. The stuff that isn't paid work that has been the most rewarding, the most fulfilling.
Yeah, which being is a much, service.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and like you say, like connecting. And I wonder how much of that has helped you move through very tricky situations, because your work with the NSPCC is motivated personally because you suffered abuse when you were a teenager from one of your coaches.
Yes.
That is obviously something that is going to take years of healing and processing. Mm. Where are you with that? How do you feel today about having to face that period of your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think the hardest point was going through the campaign stuff and in recall, doing interviews about it, you know, and drawing on your experience to help the campaign. And I actually struggled quite a lot that period, and I didn't realise it more than anything. It's just, you know, I was having to relive some of the minor incidents that happened to me with this coach to newspapers like The Express, and that just to draw, in order to help the campaign, in order to draw experience and kind of add weight to the campaign, I draw one or two of the sort of lesser minor incidents, if you could call them that, that happened to me. Because one of the things that I realised with this happened over a three-year period. I can't remember how many times it happened. And we're talking sort of incidents from very minor to like borderline, which you could deem as rape, sexual abuse, whatever term you want to use. But it just in recalling this sort of stuff and going on your own experiences to add weight to the campaign and doing interviews and trying to really beef it up, I found that I was, it took me back, and I was recalling lots of the incidents that happened in my head over and over again, particularly this guy's face. And it really hit me hard the week after that, really. So I have to be careful how much I do in order to help other people at the expense of myself, really, because I probably took it for granted a little bit that I was through this and I was fine. You know, there's a timeline with it and there's a process to go through. And I was probably earlier in that process than I thought I was, really. And
Because you'd been so used to blocking it out?
I think maybe, yeah. And I've never seen a therapist. Probably something I should do, really.
Yeah.
I've had to deal with it all myself.
Really?
Yeah, I've lost trust in therapists. Mm. So last April was the first time I came out about it with Alistair in Men's Health.
Yeah.
So I thought, you know, year on, you know, kind of, I'm right now, I can talk about it. Yeah, I can help anyone, you know. Do you want me to tell you what happened to me? And he started doing stuff like that. You know, I was like, I found that actually, Brad, you're not, this is pretty heavy now. And I had to back off a little bit after that because, you know, and then NSPC were like, you know, we'd love you to get involved in more campaigns and stuff like that. But I go, you know, I have to be careful here. I need to make sure that I'm all right.
Yeah.
And I think I underestimate. And that was the first red flag for me, really. So a couple of weeks off not thinking about it. But not thinking about it is not actually dealing with it, is it, really? So it was a learning experience in that process for me, really. And I'm still early in that process. And as you just said, this is something that's going to take a long time to. And I hadn't appreciated that. I thought the minute you sort of say it and go, yeah, I'm over it now.
Yeah.
But it was a wake-up call.
Yeah, I think one of the hardest things, I guess, with any type of trauma is that it could be a life's work in dealing with it. And sometimes there are situations where you might never make complete peace, but it's still worth walking down the road.
I never considered it a trauma.
Really?
No. And it, you know, what is a trauma, really? I had a knife put to my throat as a kid and things like that. And I always think of that as like terrifying moments. So I always sort of considered that to be a trauma. But I don't know what a trauma's supposed to feel like. You know, is a trauma, you know, it's something that you kind of can't think about or whatever. I don't know. And I think that's been the learning process with this, is I'm learning new definitions to what we throw words around, like trauma all the time and stuff.
Yeah.
Because I've started to understand that, you know, it's not something that you recall in memory that, because I recall things in memory and not be fine about them. We could talk about them and be candidly open. But I think sometimes it's in doing that, it's the abnormality of something that I struggle to get my head around sometimes as well. And the phrase I've used a few times, certainly in Mind magazine, was the greatest shame was that another man had done this act to me. And that was my greatest shame, is that I couldn't get my head around the sort of abnormality of that. That's not supposed to be right, it's particularly 13. I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, that is a trauma, isn't it? You know, because the reaction to it,
it is. And also, the reaction can be one that is deemed success, which yours was. You know, it doesn't always have to be the reaction is awful.
Yeah.
Your reaction was to push yourself to the point of global success.
I think
success.
From that moment it happened, I pretended it didn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the easiest way to deal with it. And then from that moment, I just dedicated my life to cycling as a distraction. But this guy as well, this guy as well, actually, he met me when I was 12 and he felt my pulse. And he said, the strength of your pulse, he says, you're going to be the greatest cyclist that's ever lived.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Yeah, he used to say that to everyone he met, and I couldn't understand why was I the one that, you know.
But this happened to other people as well. You found out since.
Well,
within...
So since then, I mean, when I announced it with Alistair Campbell, I had three messages from three different club mates who were in the same club at the time. Said, looking back, we kind of all knew really, and we should have all done more to help you.
But that's what the campaign that you've been running has been about, is spotting signs, is not feeling scared to intervene.
A lot of it's just common sense.
Yeah.
You know, there's not sort of remembering 10 things, you know, if this, that.
Yeah.
Sometimes the effects of abuse aren't clear and recognisable. But, you know, we all have a duty. We can all sense when there's something not right with the child. And even just that aloofness, quietness, it's just, even if you don't sense it, it's just something, you know, just... befriended a child to ask them if they could talk to you about anything, if there's anything you want to talk about, feeling that comfort, feeling that protection. I think that's the biggest one, is feeling someone that you feel protected by.
Yeah.
And a lot of kids lack protection in childhood. And it's just common sense. A lot of it's common sense as a human being. It's not about, I didn't recognise the signs. It's just ask kid if he's all right.
Mm.
You know, and that fear of intervening, yes, you know, fear of being wrong, you know, that fear of accusing someone or something, or the insinuation of something to someone that is... you know, upsetting for people, but it's, it's a funny one, isn't it? But again, this campaign I was got involved in, it's the starting point. I can't believe nothing's been done like that before.
Yeah.
It just shows you how behind we are. And even when I did that, you know, one of the things I recognise with that, in asking questions and answering questions of a lot of these people, is how political it starts getting after a while. You know, it starts getting about money and funding and are they doing enough and statistics and all this. And then sometimes the questions have to be, you know, steered towards the CEO and the chairman of the NSPCA, because I couldn't answer after questions on political stuff. I realised that it's a lot of politics and money and financial stuff. Lots of it starts getting in the way of actual action being taken and being done.
Yeah.
And I imagine it's tough work and a barrier for these people. And
but it's very important to have the storytelling side of it, as painful as that has been and will be for you.
I think
it's deeply powerful, because there'll be people listening to this now who may have experienced very similar to you.
I agree.
And it could be completely, you know, kept in an insular way to them, which is doing them no good at all.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned a moment ago a feeling which is obviously prevalent in this area, which is shame. And I've definitely had periods of my life where I've been sort of drowning in shame, and it's a horrible, ugly emotion, and one that's very hard to negate when you've got a past like this. So how do you deal with those feelings? How are you moving through it and getting on with your life?
As part of that process, by talking about it, and obviously it has an effect on me when I talk about it at that time, but I have to learn to come away from that and recover. It's a bit like doing a race. You know, I empty myself and then recover, and that's part of the process as well. But that's it. Even though it has an after effect in talking about it to that extent, I just have to give myself time and space afterwards to recover and heal. But it's a bit like training as a cyclist. You know, you train your body, you damage the muscle, you repair it, and it grows stronger. So I think this is part of the process for me as well. Is it's never a case of just leaving it never talking about it again, but in talking about it and sharing it, that's the fulfilling part, is in sharing that story with other people and maybe touching one or two people. Some of the message I got after various campaigns and things I've done have been really, really rewarding and touching for me and fulfilling. But it's not something I can focus on constantly. You know, it's like a constant, it needs time to rest and the right environment as well, and then come back to it. So that has been the most rewarding thing, is seeing the effect or touching one or two people and their experiences. But it definitely needs time afterwards where you have to just shut it down and some mental recovery, because this isn't something you can just go to therapy twice a week for and constantly keep touching on traumas. Because I think, like, the people that have gone to therapy that told me that you start tapping into a trauma, it leaves you drained for days afterwards.
Yeah.
And that's what I've got to be careful of, really. So it has been a learning experience for me, really.
Do you think therapy is on the cards? Is it something you'll consider?
I have to, yeah. I suppose I have to at some point, yeah.
I mean, there's so many...
Where do you start, though?
Where do you start? I mean, there's so many interesting different therapeutic things these days. Yeah. EMDR therapy, cognitive, somatic work. I mean, it's definitely worth a go.
No, I think I'm going to definitely... There's a lot of fear associated with that as well, I think.
From you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm almost scared to find out what I'm going to find out.
Yeah.
And that's probably not what I've been ready for up to this point, but I'm kind of ready for it now. Like I said, fear's always been a driving force in my life. And I think that fear is attached to the unknown, really, because obviously there's a lot with my father as well, which is attached to that subject, because I wish he'd been around more. And it's very, very, it's very complex, you know.
So that was another driving force for your determination during your career, was your dad was very absent from when you were a tiny kid.
Yeah.
And you also, not only was he absent, but you idolised him. You had this slightly warped vision of who he was to you.
Well, he was a professional cyclist. And I grew up knowing all about him. My mum always told me about him, but she glorified him in a cycling sense. I've got so seen pictures of him and everything. What he was good at, this, that and the other. He was a hard Australian who liked fighting. But she also glorified all his bad traits. You know, he was violent. He was aggressive towards her, me, and there were very many other people, but he was an alcoholic. Probably bipolar when I look back. You know, they called him manic depressive, but he certainly struggled from bipolar, probably because lots of people told me since he was never liked being on his own and things like that. So I kind of, it's in this sort of bizarre situation I found myself in my teens with my coach. You know, I had a stepfather who was physically violent towards me a lot. But most kids' dads were in the 80s, you know, it was like a different time. This was before the New Age Man. And I always wished my dad was around, really, to protect me. You know, I always wished I had a father figure around to protect me. And so that was part of the drive in cycling as well, is trying to show him, prove to him and follow his footsteps. So I took up cycling. My mum pushed me into cycling. She never stopped loving my father. And, you know, she said, your dad never wanted you to be a cyclist, but I think you'll be really good at it. So I kind of took up cycling. Then that started happening. It was pretty much as soon as I started cycling with my coach. And I just wished I'd had a dad around. So the part of the drive and the fear was just that that was the closest connection I could have with my father, was just following his footsteps, really.
I mean, you sort of reconnected with him in your late teens. So how
I did,
was that?
So when I was going through my teens and cycling, everywhere I went, everyone knew who my dad was. Because my dad was feared and revered. When I was in the cycling world, it was like having a dad, because they'd all say, "Oh, you're Wigo's boy, aren't you? God." And it was like having Ronnie Cray as your dad, you know, that kind of thing. It was a little bit, you know, like people would be a bit scared, but a bit. And I say Ronnie Cray because they were terrified of him as well, because he was a liability and a loose cannon. But it was like having a dad in the cycling world for the first time. You know, and it's like, is he going to be like his dad was? You know, and like, so it was like I had this sort of strength of my dad without him being around. And as I got better and better, and I sort of, it was this weird dynamic of, it was the closest I could be to my dad is in the cycling world, because name was always, people come up to me, "Oh, you're Gary, aren't you?" No, "Oh, sorry, you're Bradley, aren't you?" Because, you know, and I got nicknamed Wigo from a young Wigo's boy and all this. So I had a dad without even him being present. Anyway, I got to 17. And I started winning junior titles and world titles. And then my nan got a phone call when I was 18, because she still had the same phone number, 3285492. She's always had it since it was 01-3285.
I love how the brain stores unuseful shit like that.
Because I always used to reverse the charges to my nans.
A classic 90s
so
move.
So my dad had her number still. He rang up and he said, "Hello, Maureen, it's Gary. It's, oh, can I speak to Brad?" So we didn't have a landline, so my nan ran through the flats. And my mum said, oh, your dad's rang. Do you want to speak to him? So anyway, that's how that... I hadn't seen him for 16 years.
And you hadn't spoken to him in 16 years?
No.
Wow.
I rang him up. He said, yeah, hello, Bradley, it's your father. And he'd seen my name in a cycling magazine in Australia, and he'd seen a B. Wiggins, and he thought, that must be Brad.
Wow.
And he wanted to be back part of my life again because I was starting to be successful.
Mm.
And, yeah, we chatted, you know, bits and pieces on the phone and stuff over the next year. I won the Junior World Championship. And then it started turning a little bit. You know, he goes, this is because you're my son, you're doing this well. And this was just all phone conversation. In the end, I went to meet him. I met my dad when I was 19 in Belgium for the first time. That was really tough when I look back. Only because I've got my own son now, you know.
Yeah.
It must be really hard. Well, it was hard meeting your dad when you're 19.
Yeah.
And him being your hero. But actually just wanting your dad your whole life.
Yeah.
But he was, by then I was really good, and he started turning on me and very competitive, and he says, you know, you'll never be as good as your old man. That's what his words were.
Wow.
And they always stuck with me from that point on.
Well, of course.
And I found myself never not liking him. Couldn't wait to get rid of him. Couldn't wait till he went back to Australia. And then for the next 12, 13 years, that was my, there was a fear, and you'll never be as good as your old man. And that was the thing that drove me for the rest of my life then. You know, and he won a European title, you know, and he was Australian champion, but, you know, I won 11 world titles, 5 Olympic golds, Tour de France, the hour record. I never stopped after that. It was all because I wanted to be better than my dad.
Wow.
And then he got murdered in 2008, and I had to deal with that. And then it was like, you know, yeah.
And that's still unresolved.
And I never went to the funeral. No, and they never found out who did
no.
it.
No. So how does that sit with you?
If he was here today, I wish there's so many questions I could ask him.
Mm.
As a man now. But the funny thing is, he was so intimidating and so cold. I think if I'd had a conversation with him, I kind of feel like I'd have just been thrust back down to an 18-year-old boy, like, get in your place, boy. And I couldn't have had an adult conversation with him and say, why did you leave and things like that, you know. So it's just left me with so many... And I could never have told about this, come out with this, the stuff, the sexual abuse stuff, because...
Yeah.
He'd have took it out of me. He wanted to kill this person for a start, but then he'd have blamed me and been quite bigoted towards me and kind of said, yeah, I can just imagine what you'd have said.
So I guess all of that led to you not saying anything for years and years and years.
Because
that is the fear again.
This is the first time I spoke about a lot about this since January, since the campaign stuff. And even now, I've healed a little bit more, and it's addressing new emotion now when I'm talking about it, which I never imagined.
That's a good thing, isn't it?
Yes.
Because it shows that you'll just keep
So it's probably time I go and speak to someone, I think.
I think so. I don't think there's ever any harm in trying therapy.
No, definitely not.
Because you can walk away if you don't like it, but at least it gives you a chance to pick through so much. I mean, there's so much for you to pick through, and the driving force that's led to your success and the unravelling after that. Because I think that's... It's a really interesting time of your life where you've got the world adoring you. And as you said, you're an introvert, so that's not pleasurable. That's quite traumatising, having everybody put their focus on you. And there was this character born from that. Sir Wiggo with the sideburns, and you're playing up to something to mask all of this stuff.
Pretty much, yeah. It was an easy veil to go out in public in. But I amplified it to the extreme, you know, and I played guitar and things like that, but I ended up playing on stage with Paul Weller at the Hammersmith Apollo, and it blurred the lines about who I actually was. And then I'd drink in and stuff like that when I was at Sports Personality of the Year, because I couldn't handle all these people watching me.
Yeah.
Really. But I played this sort of character on stage and then rolled out a Whiskey Misc at 1 a.m. on the front page of the newspapers. And lots of people loved it because we hadn't seen a sportsman like this. But then when I wanted to come back to Mr. Serious, who'd won 5 Olympic golds, and talk about the process and how I'd done it and the ability to execute an Olympic final, no one wanted to know about that.
Mm.
You know, they wanted to know what jam songs you liked and things like this. And I found myself, I invented this character and made this character and amplified him, that it took away from what I was really good at and the skill and the genius I had inside me as an athlete.
So when you get rid of the sideburns and you're like, right, I'm not doing that character anymore... Was there a sense of, I don't know who I am?
Yeah, massively. I had an identity crisis, if you like. I'd been a cyclist for so long, I'd only known who Sir Bradley Wiggins was, a cyclist, really, and how to be him in public when people are coming up to you saying, you're a legend, you're a hero, you've changed my life, you're an inspiration, play it all cool. No, don't mention it, you know, all this sort of stuff. But
So when you, if you're faced with a picture of Sir Wiggo sat on the throne, Hampton Court. How do you feel about that?
Well, the whole crossing the legs things up, that was because there was a bank of cameras watching me and feeling the need to perform. And it was that feeling the need to perform and never just being able to sit there and take the moment in and be, you know, respectful to the moment. It's just, even when the National Anthem was playing, I was doing all this, I couldn't take praise for one, and I couldn't take adulation really. But I played to the adulation and looked like I was enjoying it and amplified it and made it worse. And it was always for me, it was always a devaluing or of a moment that was supposed to be humbling and take it in and enjoy the moment. I always have to make a sort of a mockery of it, be funny in that moment, whether it was playing the National Anthem in Rio when I stuck my tongue out, whether it was, you know, sitting on the throne doing that, or going up to Sports Personality of the Year and calling Susan, things like that. It was always sort of making a joke in the moment of something that was serious, and I was unable to, and I don't know why that was. The only time that I was really serious and proper was when I went to meet the Queen for my knighthood, and it was really humbling. I think it was a false sense of belief, and all the training, dedication, everything, that was just an excuse to go and do something that distracted myself. But when it actually came to it and I executed and won the thing, I couldn't believe it, because I had to come back to me at that point. And I was like, how have I done this? No, this isn't right. You know, I don't deserve this. And I had that moment that through my whole career, from that Tour de France for five Olympic golds. When I watched Stephen Redgrave win five Olympic golds when I was a kid, you know, Steve was the epitome of hard work and training and dedication over a long period of time. And then when I did it, I had to pull my tongue out on the podium there, because it wasn't the same. It's like, this isn't the same Olympics that Steve Redgrave did. And that's what I always had, is my character and personality was so different to the likes of Michael Johnson, Carl Lewis, Steve Redgrave, these people, Chris Hoy, that all stemmed from my childhood, the lack of confidence and things like that. Yeah. So it carried throughout my career. More than ever, I guess, in terms of I know who I am as a person, and I'm happy being me. And the only way to be me is to be open, honest, and, you know, candid about my experiences, with the lack of shame. But I can't recognise at all the cyclist anymore, that Sir Wiggo person. I know who he was, but I'm far removed from that person now. I couldn't be him as an athlete anymore. I can't understand how he did that. But as a person off the bike, it's worlds apart. So I am happier being me, yeah. But then the contradiction with that is when I go down the street and someone wants to stop me and say, "Hey, Sir Bradley, can I just have a photo with you?" I'm almost replacing him that was doing it. it's this kind of split personality thing almost.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's interesting how we view success, because most people are striving to be a success in whatever they do. It might not even be in terms of work, but yeah, in whatever their dreams and desires are, assuming that that will equal some sort of completion and final euphoria and happiness. Yeah. And you're actually saying you're happier today than you were sat atop the throne.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I wouldn't be here today and that person without that. I've kind of had to go through all those experiences, but that doesn't define me. You know, and I battle with people every day that say to me, you know, you must be so proud of what you've done. It's like, not really. Well, not proud is the wrong word. I am, you know, I'm proud. No, you should be. You should be proud of it. Honestly, if that was me, I'd do this. You know, they always tell you what they would do. But half the reason that people can't imagine doing something like that is because normal people can't. Like, if I was like this as a child, I wouldn't have had this sort of desire and the drive and the push. I was like, what, 6 hours a day on a bike? No, God, I'm going to get a normal job. But you have to have something different about you, and there has to be something quite odd about you. I was a very odd child. You know, I was I was obsessed with cycling. You know, I could tell you. So this is another thing now as well, that because I threw myself into cycling, I became like a sponge to cycling. When I do cycling commentary and things now, they call me the Oracle, because I know everything. You know, what shoes someone was wearing in 1996, what race they won, anything. It was like a religion to me. And, yeah, and now I don't really pay an interest in cycling. I couldn't care less who's done what. I don't really know after rides anymore, what their names are. I don't watch cycling anymore, which is why I'm finding it harder to do the job, because I have no interest in it. It filled a massive void in my life with a view to being close to my dad and things like that.
And escapism.
And now people say, oh, it's a shame you've fallen out of love with cycling. It's like, I was never in love with it. It became a religion. You don't fall in love with a religion. You adopted a religion, and I adopted a religion of cycling. And now I've left my faith, if you like. Mm. It's not that I was ever in love with it, or I've never been on the bike. You should get back on the bike. You know, it's a shame you lost the love for the bike. Normal people love cycling. They go out, they love getting the bike. I can't stand it. I hated cycling, really, the act of riding a bike. It just gave me, it was a means, it was to facilitate what I wanted to do in my life.
So how do you feel about your son, who's now at an extremely successful level already as a teenager?
I'm incredibly proud of him, yeah. But I was already proud of him as a person. That's the important thing now. I never really got involved in his cycling career because I always wanted to just be his dad first and foremost, which stemmed from mine. I didn't want to be the one who pushed him into cycling, the coach, and, you know, coached him, getting him back from school at night and saying, right, you need to go and do those 2 hours on the bike. He comes to me now and goes, do you think I should train today, Dad? I said, how do you feel? You know, and I can have a proper father-son relationship with him. He's got coaches, and I'm there as his dad, first and foremost, his mentor, deal with problems in his life that are not cycling-related. And that was very important for me. But, you know, I love him to bits. I'm incredibly proud of him. And I think he'll be better than I am as a cyclist, you know.
Wow, that's exciting.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
How do you feel with him moving towards that, with the press attention that will be in him? Because that's a whole other shit show that you've had to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, he had it last week, actually. He had a journalist email him because he liked an Andrew Tate tweet. But that is kind of like what he's got to be careful of.
Yeah.
So he is aware of that. And it's, you know, he's got management now, and how they deal with that is up to them. But it just shows you that, you know, you have to, the spotlight's on you from any point of view now, whatever you're doing.
I mean, one of the times when the press obviously tried to take you down the most was when there was a term within about 4-year period of you being the hero to the alleged villain with the doping allegations.
Yeah.
How do you deal with the injustice of stories being printed without proof?
Well, there was no insinuation. There was no actual allegation. I mean, there was the whole thing with that was there was no one actually said what it was that I was being accused of. But it was all in their interests, you know, to make this thing go away. Because it was all to do with public money and things like that. But it's very sinister. And there's a reason I'm still sat here today. And people seem to still like me and things like this. Because I've continued being myself through the whole process. And no one actually said what it was that... There was this accusation of doping. But no one could actually tell you what it was. So, I mean, it's just an incredible turnaround, really. As you say, from that 4-year period to this, really. And that is, it's all gone quiet now. You don't really hear much about it anymore.
No.
I was very bitter for a couple of years, but at the end of the day, you've got to start. I don't really pay much attention to him anymore, and I occupy myself with stuff that's really fulfilling and rewarding, really. Yeah, it's been a turbulent couple of years since I stopped.
So what have you discovered in this time? Since this discovery that you don't want to play a character, that you are quite happy to leave professional cycling to one side. What makes you tick? What is doing it for you?
My children now, really. I think they've been... I found it very difficult to find something to occupy my time with, really. I get bored very easy and I do need to occupy myself, but I also need something that I'm fucking passionate about and that I'm... that really I buy into that gets me out of bed in the morning. And that's been a very, very difficult thing to find. Very difficult. But my children now, really, giving them the time and attention and love and happiness that I can as much as possible individually, because they're all of ages now, they're all different ages that they need my individual time. It's not a case of all getting them together and going to Disneyland, because they couldn't pass that, you know. And like my son texted me yesterday and said, do you fancy coming to Glasgow next week to look at the World Junior Time Trial course, which is in the World Championships in Glasgow this year? So that's a 2-day trip, you know. And I'm kind of, I'm on there on standby for my kids, really. I mean, it's like I should get a pager, really, because whether it's, you know, Dad, I need 20 quid.
Yeah.
Can I go at Nando's? Yeah. and I'm kind of like that all the time with them, really. Other than that, I still haven't found a daily thing, you know, that... nature of my work is it's quite bitty, you know, and this is coming along, you know, and I think I'm getting more to the place now where this side of things, you know, the mental health thing and the child neglect and abuse thing, is probably going to become more of my, I'd like it to become more of a daily job where I'm not dealing with my own trauma so much, but helping others.
And if you feel your past nipping at your heels, if you start to have a day where you feel like it's all too much and you're slipping into a dark place, do you have any techniques to get yourself out of it or ways to deal with it?
No, not really. I have to keep myself in a routine. That's the main thing. Routine, I have to go and train, do the gym or running daily, because that kind of sets the tone for the rest of the day for me then. And if I'm prone to leaving that till late in the day, I'll go tonight, the day's already gone. So I do have to get into a routine where I start my day with that, and it kind of sets the tone for the rest of the day. Then and it held me in good stead for many, many years when I was training. And it took me 5 or 6 years to realise that 1 hour sets the tone for the rest of the day then, because there's no chasing your tail from that point on. It's that, really. It's the routine and planning a structure to the week, really. So whatever it is, even if it's something as small as making a phone call, things like that, is... Now, I say all this, I don't do it. I don't implement it.
I talk about a lot of stuff that I don't do.
I've realised I have to do something because I'm prone to slipping.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's good. You've got you know, things in place to help you out.
But these are all the things I've only just learned in 2023.
Yeah.
So it's funny, you know, I vowed at the end of 2022, I was like, I want to make this the best year of my life, if you like. I don't want to be where I am at the end of 2022 and the end of 2023. And it was nearly March, and I thought, fuck that one up, haven't I? but having talked to you, I realised that I've actually made some positive things. It's been,
But I don't think it have to be these sort of monumental moments. It's tiny everyday stuff.
I stopped smoking last year.
That's good.
Yeah. And that one went under the radar. Yeah, so it's just... It's that. It's these, like you said, these not these big... You have to make a massive, monumental thing. It's just a lot of it's just realising some things in your life sometimes.
Yeah.
And then it's a case of implementing them. But I think the next biggest thing for me is addressing and going to therapy.
Yeah.
But it's fine in the therapist. You're fine. Because I've always found this thing, you know, I don't know... I went in a therapist's office once and I walked out because... He had a picture of me on the wall and he asked if he could actually sign it before I left.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah, and I thought, well, this is a bad start.
It's a terrible start.
Yeah.
No, find one that doesn't do that. But I think it would be a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It seems like it's the right time to do it.
I think timing's everything.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is, you know, I think the fear of going into a therapist's office and closing up, not, there's an element of like, but I'm at a stage now where I can pretty much offload.
Yeah, and that's their job to get it out of you as well.
Yeah,
so you have to put that emphasis on yourself, maybe.
Yes.
But I think it's brilliant. And I really appreciate you talking about all this stuff today, because I know it doesn't come without that slight mental hangover afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, draining. I totally understand that. So I really appreciate
you. No, it's fine, because I did spot a pub at the end of the road before I came.
That's not the way to
I'll
turn
probably
up
be in there for the rest of the day now.
Oh, God.
Thanks, Fern.
It's all gone pear-shaped. Well, honestly, thank you
so much,
Sir Bradley. It's been a joy.
Been a privilege. Thank you very much.
Well, that was an incredibly raw chat with Bradley. And I honestly never take it for granted just how difficult, but also draining it is to retell experiences like that. So, Bradley, I cannot thank you enough for spending time with me and for all the great work you're doing with the NSPCC and Mind. Do check the show notes, by the way, if you want to get involved in Ride London with Mind. It's a fantastic cause, a charity that I adore. And if you want to carry on any of the conversations we've had here today with the rest of the Happy Place community, do come find us on Instagram. We're at Happy Place Official. Until next time, a huge thank you again to Sir Bradley, to the producer, Anushka Tate, who should be a dame, at Rethink Audio, and to you. Take care of yourself. Big love, people.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.